Lawmakers prepare for another session in Tallahassee with redistricting and COVID on the mind. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Those are just some of the big topics that we can expect to see legislators deal with over the next couple of months. We're going to talk to Democrat Representative Dan Daley of Coral Springs. Also, what can we do to fix our schools?
Why don't we take a deeper look at public education, try to take more pride in it, and maybe use it to solve some of our social problems?
A conversation with the sociologist at FIU about his TED Talk and how we can help kids be more successful. And finally, finding happiness in 2021. We look back at some of our favorite moments. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Florida lawmakers will be making their way to Tallahassee next week in preparation for the 2022 legislative session. This year's session starts earlier than non-election years. That's because of the midterm elections. Once again, Republicans hold both the House and Senate and the governor's office. So the question is, what can Democrats achieve when they have such big hurdles to overcome? We're joined now by Democratic Representative Dan Daley of District 97, which is in Coral Springs. Representative Daley, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Luis. Happy to be with you. Thanks for having me.
So you're going into this session. We're in a surge of the Omicron variant. How do you see the pandemic playing out during the session compared to last year? Because remember, last year, the Capitol at one point was closed to the public.
You know, that's a great point. As a matter of fact, it was closed to the public all the way through our 60-day session. And on the day after session ended, suddenly the Capitol opened back up. What you have not seen, and mind you, session starts next Tuesday, is any formal protocol, any serious protocol for the session, for the Capitol. No mask orders, no testing requirements, no social distancing rules. They're all just merely suggestions. And I would argue, you know, look, while Omicron luckily has not been as deadly as other variants, it's everywhere. And I think that's it's not just here in Florida, it's all across this country. And so we're going full steam ahead into a very person-to-person contact process with no actual standards in place. But that's really what you've seen in other parts of the state as well, is really a lack of leadership and seriousness when it comes to COVID in general. And look, not to take shots at Governor DeSantis, but you've got a governor who got up at the podium the other day and stressed early testing and early intervention. And a couple of minutes later, his Surgeon General got up and said that we need to get away from testing and that the antibody treatment is the only way to handle this situation. Well, you don't know that you need the antibody treatment if you don't know you have COVID.
You know, I mean, I want to get your take on this. You're going to have lawmakers who have not been vaccinated, do not wear masks.
Sure.
You know, again, as you said, you have a lot of people in a tight space. And you yourself have had COVID. I mean, how do you feel going into this?
That's right. So not only did I managed now, Luis, to catch it twice. I actually had it again about a week and a half ago, and I'm cleared. I have a negative test. And I was doing all of those things. I was wearing a mask. I was social distancing, continuing to do those things. That's how transmissible Omicron has been. And so, you know, look, my symptoms this time around, thank God, were much more minor than my first go around with it. But I think it's a real concern. And if you look at the number of people, twofold, right? The impact that it's going to have on the economy when folks are calling out sick as they should with Omicron. But then you look at the hospital situation, not just in South Florida, but all across Florida, where you have a lack of hospital beds. I was talking to a nurse, one of the main nurses at Memorial Regional in Hollywood. They had 115 more patients than they do beds in the hospital on Monday night. And you're not just seeing that in Hollywood, you're seeing that all across the state. I don't know that we're prepared to fully address a lot of what's been going on.
Yeah, and as we had pointed out on the program yesterday, that with Omicron, we've seen, you know, almost a 300% increase, or more, actually more than that, you know, over the last few weeks. But, I mean, this is news. You've had it twice now?
Yes, sir.
Having it twice, how has that shaped your view of vaccinations and testing and the role that government plays in this issue.
Yeah. You know, listen, Lewis, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I went to law school to kind of avoid science, right? But I know what I don't know, and I know that I can listen and trust those in the medical field, those frontline healthcare workers, those scientists that are learning more and more every day about COVID and its different variants. And I want to trust those people. I want to empower those people to put out the correct information. And what you have seen in this state is certain individuals are more worried about their reelection or more worried about their future political ambitions than they are about being serious about the COVID, about COVID and any of the variants.
Look, this has become, I don't have to tell you, this has become a divisive and political issue. And you have, you know, basically the CDC and you have the medical profession telling us one thing. And then, of course, you've got people, you know, challenging all of it and sometimes spreading misinformation and people getting kicked off social media because of the misinformation they're spreading. How do we overcome that? Because here we are again, Florida, one of the leading states in the spread of this variant. How do we overcome that in the messaging?
I think it requires leadership. I think it requires leadership at the very top, and that goes from the governor all the way down to folks to actually admit and accept the science that exists around COVID. I kid you not, you may remember a couple weeks ago, we were in Tallahassee for a special session on COVID, basically pushing someone's future political agenda rather than worrying about everyday Floridians. And I heard 4 hours worth of testimony. Can I give you a couple examples of that testimony? We had a gentleman stand up and with a straight face say that the CDC has a clandestine plot to kill Americans. That is the type of public testimony that was solicited during that special session, right? You had folks come up and say things like that, deny that COVID was an actual pandemic, deny that COVID even existed, right? We need to get past that. This is serious. Our hospitals are overcrowded. And it's going to continue, unfortunately, in that direction until you have folks who are willing to admit that the truth still exists and that we should defer to the people that know what they're talking about in the medical space and the science space and not just what my uncle posted on Facebook.
You know what? Yeah, and that's interesting you bring that up. And I'm going to push that aside for a second because that comes to messaging, and I want to come back to that. So much to talk about for this session. And one of the big things that's going to kick off really and probably take up a big chunk of the beginning of the session is the redistricting. This is a redistricting year. The maps are being redrawn. Has there been enough public input in this process? Because it feels like it hasn't.
1,000% no. Redistricting, Lewis, as you know, redistricting is probably the most important job of the legislature. It only happens once every decade, right? But we are physically drawing the lines for the next 10 years of the folks who will get to elect people to represent them at all levels of government, right? It is the foundation really of our democracy at the most basic level. And there has to be sufficient public input. And you haven't seen that. 10 years ago, when they went through the redistricting process, the legislature basically went on a statewide tour and they hosted listening sessions all across the state. Now, listen, with COVID being the reality the last 2 years, I understand why that may not have been advisable, may not have been feasible. But you know what? Everybody can use Zoom. Everybody can use all of these new mechanisms for public virtual meetings. We could have hosted public virtual meetings even more than we did 10 years ago in different parts of the state to solicit public input. And that wasn't done. So your only option really was to schlep 6 hours, and if not more, depending on where you live in the state of Florida, to Tallahassee to testify and to be able to be part of that process. Mind you, you'd be given a minute or two to speak and driven all that way. You've taken time off of work. You've taken time away from your family to go up there and talk about it. We should have been making this as easy as possible for people to weigh in. The website we put up, they said, the leadership has said, well, the public has the opportunity to weigh in on the website. So I asked in committee, I said, well, is anybody a staff or anybody reviewing the submissions online? The answer was conceptually yes. I don't know what that means. I like a yes or a no. But basically what the online system has amounted to is a very transparent trash can. If we're not looking at the public input, we're not putting it as part of our process, drawing these maps, what's the point in doing it in the first place?
I'd imagine that your party is probably discussing the legal options after those maps are drawn. Do you see that really what's going to happen?
You know, look, and it's unfortunate that it has to come to that. And if it does, you know, we'll see, because obviously we're not in the final version of the maps. Ultimately, look, we have to follow the fair districting amendments. We have to follow the existing law. And that, you know, and that produces the most fair, not fair for Republicans, not fair for Democrats, the most fair maps, period, for the public. And that's the end goal. And whether that requires litigation down the road or not is yet to be seen. But our hope, and that's what we keep pushing for, is an open, transparent, and fair process.
Again, talking with Democratic State Representative from South Florida, Dan Daly, we're talking about the upcoming legislative session. It's 60 days in Tallahassee, and that starts January 11th. That's next week. So, Representative, obviously the ultimate job of the legislature is to pass a state budget. Considering the divisiveness, though, right now between the two parties, I mean, do you anticipate that going smoothly, or what roadblocks are there ahead of us?
Sure. You know, and look, and you hit the nail on the head. The budget is the most important thing that we do every year. It is the only constitutional requirement that we have every single year. We don't have to pass a single piece of legislation as long as we pass the budget. And it's a budget that needs to work for all Floridians, not just those that are tuned in and paying attention and hiring folks to represent them in Tallahassee. And so it's yet to be seen. We're going through that process. You know, look, there are times where there are a lot of good components of the budget, where you see good bipartisan support of the budget. I've seen years where all members, both Republican and Democrats, save a few here or there, voted and supported a budget. And that's the ultimate goal that we'd like to get to, but it's yet to be seen for this cycle. If you look at the governor, what I find a little interesting is if you look at the governor's proposed budget, one third of it is federal dollars. So the governor is happy to take shots at the federal government over COVID and this and that and anything that helps move his narrative, but you're using a third of your own proposal of federal dollars.
You know, after having worked in local government, as you have in Coral Springs, when the Parkland shooting happened in 2018, the issue of guns is a big issue for you. My understanding is that there's a roundtable conversation coming up this afternoon with other Democratic lawmakers. I think U.S. Representative Ted Deutsch will be leading the way, talking about gun safety. That's today, right?
Yes, sir. That's actually right after this. It's a good roundtable, and it's Congressman Deutsch, State Senator Tina Polsky, myself, and the former mayor of Parkland, and my colleague now in the state legislature, Representative Christine Hunchofsky. All of us try, both at the federal level and at the state level, and candidly at the local level as well, to advance legislation that you know really gets at that gun issue. Right, there's gun violence rampant in parts of this country, and we need to do something. 74% of Floridians just 2 years ago said we want to see action on this issue, even if it's just the low-hanging fruit. I filed a bill called Jamie's Law, named after Jamie Guttenberg, who was tragically killed at my high school at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and working with her father Fred, we've drafted this bill to try and be as reasonable as possible. We say that in the state of Florida, there are prohibited purchasers, people who are prohibited from purchasing and owning a firearm. That also means they're prohibited from owning and purchasing ammunition, but there's no way to verify whether or not they're going and buying that ammunition. So all Jamie's Law does is say, hey, listen, there's going to be a background check on ammunition. We've included exceptions. We've included some carve outs. If you have a concealed carry permit, if you're going hunting, if you're going to the firing range, if you're doing those kind of things, you would be exempted. But at least it gets at those folks who, you know, if you play out that narrative of bad guys don't follow the law, right now today in the state of Florida, if the bad guy goes to a gun shop and purchase, he can purchase as much ammunition as he wants. There's never anything to stop that person.
How far has that bill gotten in the past?
It has never seen the light of day in Tallahassee, and it's really unfortunate, because if you actually read the bill and read what we're trying to do and all the different exceptions and everything else that we've tried to accommodate for, it's really a shame. The way we look at it, it's common sense. It's stopping that prohibited purchaser, that quote bad guy or gal, from going and amassing as much ammunition as they'd like, because they found a gun, they bought it on the black market, they stole it, whatever the case may be. They get their hands on that firearm, they can go buy as much ammunition as they like.
I think if I recall, there's also conversations about open carry and possibly even allowing people to have guns in Florida without a permit. Where do you think that's going to?
That's right.
Where do you think that's going to land?
I am hopeful that calmer heads will prevail. The folks who have filed that legislation in Tallahassee tend to be the extreme right side of the aisle. And I hope, you know, look, college campus carry has come up in years past. Constitutional carry, which is the one you just talked about, has come up in the past. Luckily, those bills have not moved through the process. And my hope is that, you know, cooler heads and smarter heads will prevail, and you won't see those move again this legislative session. But look, there's always a threat. The bill is filed. It has the opportunity to work its way through the process.
There's another bill. There's action that you want to take, which is giving local governments, more power on gun restrictions. And, you know, our podcast, The Tallahassee Takeover, which you were part of that episode, looked at this issue, again, of Tallahassee bringing all of its power, taking that power away from local governments and making it a state control. But how do you see that? I mean, again, because Republicans have the House and Senate and the governor's office, they've been getting all the power back up in Tallahassee. Really, what chance is there that you know, your legislation on letting local governments, you know, have their own gun restrictions, how would that even see the light of day?
You know, Lewis, I'll be honest. I'm a realist, right? I think it is certainly an uphill battle, but essentially that bill would do away with the preemption that exists today to the state when it comes to guns and ammunition. And so it gives, as far as I'm concerned, if the state is not willing to act, if the state is not even willing to have a conversation on the issue of gun violence and how to address it, then let local governments do it. You have duly elected officials all across this state ready and willing to take action. And let's be honest, right? Downtown Coral Springs is not Apopka, is not Wikiwachi, right? I mean, they're every part of the state is different. And so if you live on a 5-acre piece of property and you want to have a backyard gun range, you know, look, I'm not against that. Have at it. As long as you're being safe and following the law, great. You have 5 acres to deal with. If you live in Boca Raton in a townhouse and you've got about 20 feet, well, heck, you probably shouldn't be permitted to have a backyard gun range there, right? So let the local governments weigh in. They know their communities best and they're willing to take action. That's my issue, not just on guns, but on a number of issues. You've seen Tallahassee with any number of preemptions every single year. As a matter of fact, one of the most egregious that I've ever seen is moving its way through the process in Tallahassee right now.
Let me finish with this. Because this is an election year, and my understanding, you're running again. I want to know what are Democrats' message? You think about, again, the state of Florida went heavy for Trump, and the messaging on their side has been that, you know, Democrats are socialists, and not just socialists in South Florida, especially not just socialists. You're socialist on a level of Nicolas Maduro from Venezuela socialist. And, you know, you got a party who also has they're buying into conspiracies like Q. What, as a Democrat, is your message when you have to deal with that?
You know, Lewis, at the end of the day, I think you will find that Democrats, and particularly Florida Democrats, believe that all Floridians deserve to be healthy, prosperous, and safe. I'm not a socialist. I'm probably one of the furthest things from a socialist, right? But that was a messaging issue during the last election, right? There was never a firm answer in response, because candidly, I think there were a lot of candidates across this state that didn't believe that the electorate would buy into that argument, that would actually believe that the Democratic Party, particularly in Florida in a lot of these elections, was socialist, right? We want the same things that you want. We want safe communities. We want the opportunity to grow a business and build a business and raise our families. We want all of those things. I don't think you're gonna see any proposal by Democrats in Tallahassee that even goes close to being, quote, socialist, right? But it's about messaging. And so at the end of the day, our message to folks is we want you to have the opportunity to be healthy, prosperous, and safe. And that's not just in the realm of COVID, that's in the realm of everything. We want you to be able to live out your lives in this awesome, incredible state, right? And make sure that there are provisions in place to help you do that.
Representative Daly, I really appreciate the time, and safe travels as you head up to Tallahassee for the session next week.
Thanks, Lewis. I really appreciate your coverage on this.
All right. Again, Democratic State Representative of South Florida, Dan Daly. Again, lawmakers convening for 60 days for the session that starts January 11th. And you can stay tuned to WLRN for more coverage on that session. Well, still to come, is the current school system failing our kids? One sociologist at FIU has some ideas on how to make it better. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. We're talking about how to fix education.
Often, our school system perpetuates the social divide. It makes worse what it's supposed to fix. That's as crazy or controversial as saying that our healthcare system isn't preventative, but somehow profits off of keeping us sick. Oops.
That sociologist Anindya Kundu, in his popular TED Talk called The Opportunity Gap in U.S. Public Education and How to Close It. Kundu is now an assistant professor of educational leadership at Florida International University, and he joins us now. Anindya, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, Lewis. I have your station on my preset, so it's awesome to be here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you so much for that. I appreciate it. You know, what observations led you to write and deliver that TED Talk? We heard a piece of it just now.
So I actually got to give a TED Talk in 2017, and that one was more about my research on student agency. Basically, how do students with a lot of structural disadvantages come to thrive? You know, homelessness, various forms of trauma, perhaps experienced incarceration. And that's basically what my research has been about, profiling students who beat the odds against them to make the case for supports that kids could use to overcome that kind of background. You know, that was a feel-good talk. I think most people could get behind that. But in 2020, I was re-invited to take the stage, and I really wanted to push the envelope or up the ante a little bit and talk about the system as a whole, because so many kids have to thrive despite the system, where if we were instead able to think about education in a little bit more holistically supportive way, think about the opportunity gap, you know, that wouldn't have to be the case.
And when you say opportunity gap in public education, elaborate for me. What are you talking about?
Sure. So, you know, it's more commonplace for us to use the term achievement gap. I think that's something we're comfortable with. We understand the achievement gap to stand for differences in performance that students have based on socioeconomic group or racial background. And what happens with that language is that we're sometimes putting the onus of achievement or underachievement on the individual student, and almost able to kind of wash our hands of you know, education being a social problem. If a student underachieves, it's because they were lazy, unmotivated, or have parents at home who just don't make them value education. Opportunity gap, I'm not the first scholar to use this term, is more encompassing and kind of makes us think about the system. It makes us think about the arbitrary factors that students have no control over that are actually more influential in determining, you know, life outcomes, like the zip code that they're born in or their racial demographic background.
And when you gave this talk, what was the reaction? I mean, did anybody challenge you?
You know, I probably expected to get a little bit more challenged than I did. But I think that's the cool thing about education, is that it's something that most people can get behind. We have differences amongst ourselves about, you know, what to teach, how to teach, when to teach, very contested, heated topics like, you know, we're seeing with critical race theory in Florida, or ethnic studies conversations. But if you simply just talk about students, teachers, and education needing more attention, more investment. You know, I made the case that education is the one place where in our, you know, capitalist society, it's not a zero-sum game. The more educated we can create communities, the better off we all become. You know, I didn't get as much backlash as I kind of expected I might.
You know, because we come back to, again, this idea, you challenged the idea that some kids just don't have what it takes, or because, again, of their background, that they're right, not going to succeed. Right. You challenge that. You think any child can succeed.
100%. And I think that's something that anyone who has spent time with young people can probably attest to. Kids love to learn. Kids love to feel like they're belonging. Kids enjoy fun. And so that's the equation we need to put back into education, is how can we make school and learning fun? And often what happens is that wealthier, more affluent schools in more, you know, cushy communities are able to create educational systems like that. They're also thriving in online education, where other communities that are typically underperforming or underinvested, under-resourced, they're struggling to, you know, meet these high-stakes standardized tests that are going to determine their funding. So it's a weirdly like punitive system that just doesn't make any sense. My research again on student agency just shows that students all care about learning. It just takes a little bit of attention to find what they're interested in and make the education relevant to their lives. And that doesn't cost anything.
And I want to talk about the student agency thing that's a part of your recent book, but come back to this thing that you just said a second ago. You have those well-to-do neighborhoods and the schools in those neighborhoods well-funded, and those students are performing well on tests. Sure. And then, of course, you have the underfunded schools. Is it just the funding? Or is there something that you see in these schools in the nice neighborhoods, the other schools, that again, in the struggling economic neighborhoods?
Thanks for asking that question. And that's kind of what I wanted to do in the TED Talk, is take a lot of this convoluted sociological theory and bring it to a conversational level. And so, you know, one case that I'd like to make is that this is like a fundamental piece of sociology, is that culture, you know, how people act, what they believe about, what they care about, is actually more of a product of structure. So if we can change the structures, we can influence culture. And that includes behavior and values. And a lot of people sometimes will say, you know, those communities don't care about education. Look at their parents, look at those kids. They're just loitering outside of the school. You know, this is conversations I'd have at coffee shops throughout New York. And the problem is that people aren't necessarily able to talk about the structures because they're more invisible. And so, you know, take Miami, for instance. There's a lot of high performing Hispanic schools in Miami, but they took about a decade or decades to turn around. And so people might look at those examples to say, hey, some minorities care about education. Why can't others? But at the same time, if you were to control for income or control for poverty in this country, the racial achievement gap almost goes away. And so we have to look at where lines of race and class are intertwined. It's a little bit difficult, but when we do so, we can really see where certain communities are being left behind. And again, in Miami, we can just look at Overtown, for example. It was thriving up until the 60s, and then these highways went through it, and now it's kind of more struggling.
Mm. I'm talking with sociologist Anindya Kundu. He's an assistant professor of educational leadership at FIU. And we heard one of his TED Talks about the opportunity gap in public education in the U.S. It's gotten over 2.5 million views. And you can check that out, by the way, on our website later today at WLRN.org. You talk about not just the cost. We talk about the cost for, you know, funding education, but you also talk about the cost for not tapping into a student's potential, what we lose. Right. What are we losing when we don't help students achieve more, when we're just helping out certain kids, not all kids? What are we losing?
Right. So, you know, I was trying to make the economic and moral argument that we have to care about the education of other people's children. And at the time, I wasn't even a parent myself. And that's how I was able to kind of get myself to care about it. Is if you think about just economics, for instance, we are falling behind so many other countries, especially during COVID right now. There are, you know, there's a recent McKinsey study and a lot of research out there that shows that K through 12 grade bands, there's so much learning loss happening. And what I'm afraid of is, what does that mean 5 to 10 years down the line when these young people are entering college or looking for jobs? And so the better educated communities we have, the stronger communities we will have in the future ready to tackle social problems such as potentially climate change, the next pandemic, mass incarceration, dwindling social security. So education is the one place where I think we can get to be a little bit more social. And then, you know, we'll let the best and brightest duke it out. But first, we have to create the ladders of opportunity for all students. Right now, schools are perpetuating inequality and kind of making the divide worse. And that's something we should be talking more about.
You know what, though? I think about that academically. I get it. But I try to think about it down on the ground level. I imagine myself a parent. I'm worried about my kid getting into the best school, my kid doing well so they can go to college. My kid, I may not be, I don't have time to worry about, well, what if those kids over there across the street or in another neighborhood are doing well? I may not be thinking about how that benefits me. So how do we convince people that that is a benefit to everybody, that you should be thinking about not just the success of your kid's school, but the one in, you know, the kid school in Overtown or Liberty City or somewhere else, that it's important for all of them to succeed. It'll be good for you too. How do you sell them on that?
You know, I think that is the question that my career is trying to answer. It's quite tough. And I'm a new parent myself, and I get it. You know, we're just trying to make it by and trying to do the best we can for our kids. And it's tough. Like, the argument is that, you know, COVID kind of decentralized the earth's tilt, right? Because we were underprepared to handle it. And so it's a little bit tough to think about, but if we had communities where students weren't, you know, poor, where there wasn't intergenerational inequality, then maybe from one of those communities, we could have someone who would come out with the next vaccine or something. And that doesn't mean that it can't be your kid, but it just means that we're thinking about the future a little bit more collectively. It doesn't mean that your kid can't go to as good of a school as they do. It just means ideally 10 years down the line, we'll have a lot more different jobs that we can't even conceive of right now because we've done so much of a better job, than we're doing right now. No. But you know, that is a tough question.
You live in Florida now. And so you found out, I'm sure by now, that this is a state that puts a lot on charter schools. You see a problem with that. Why?
I don't necessarily see a problem with charter schools, but I think what is difficult is access. And what typically happens with charter schools or other kinds of good schools and nice communities is the access issue. So what's happening is that a lot of parents who are maybe overtaxed, work too many jobs in this climate, are essential workers that have to go to work. They don't necessarily have the tools to navigate the system to be able to apply to a charter school or a lottery system to be able to make sure that their kid is even going to get a shot. And so sometimes what the issue that I have with charter schools is that we've put them on a playing field where sometimes the dollars going to them are taking away from other schools where those kids are likelier to go. And, you know, I don't think it has to be a if then, then this. I don't think it has to be an and or. We could just put more state and federal funding into all of education. And it wouldn't have to be such a dichotomy or a conversation where we're trying to pick and choose.
The same thing with private schools?
The same thing with private schools. Yeah. I mean, private schools are, you know, that's something we could talk about for a whole semester at FIU.
All right. Well, because of time, I'll do this. Let's say I gave you the ability to invest in public education right now. I say, here's a check. Do it. Three things you'd invest in right now.
Okay. First, 100% is paying teachers more. Teachers in poorer communities are getting paid less. And then we wonder why those schools are underperforming. Teachers are obviously undermotivated in those situations. So we have to kind of equalize and democratize teacher pay. Another thing we have to do is think about bringing in community resources into schools that could use them. You know, so many of these students come to school with problems that are outside of the school's reach, toothaches, you know, mental health problems, just broken families that they want to talk about. How can we connect those students to community resources and mentors from around the community to help them, you know, think about the relevance of what they're learning and also lead happy and holistic lives? And the last one I'll say is, like, I'll relate it to what's happening in South Florida. You know, we're at this moment right now that I think is pretty pivotal. businesses are booming, venture capital is booming, startups are fleeting to South Florida. But we have to think about what communities are being invested in and which communities are being disinvested from. You know, we can look at the gentrification of Wynwood. Yeah. Some businesses are thriving and other communities are being kind of pushed out. So how can we connect sectors? How can we connect businesses to high schools and offer job opportunities to low-income students so that those communities can lift up their future generations into economic sustainability?
You know, the last 2.5 years, we've had the pandemic, which has changed so many things. And I wonder if the pandemic has changed any of your observations.
No, and that's the sad thing, is that like when things like this happen, sometimes the most vulnerable communities continue to get beat down. Essential workers are typically Black and brown and low income, and then they can't figure out childcare when school goes remote. Sometimes teachers, due to implicit or explicit biases, are now potentially saying that students who they consider problem students are showing COVID symptoms when they might just have a cold or have allergies. So there's ways in which we're taking away school from the kids who need it the most. And, you know, the learning loss is real. And who is going to be impacted by the learning loss? It's those kids who don't have parents who can supplement their learning with, you know, varsity tutoring or after school enrichment programs. So, you know, if you just think about this longer term, we're already worried about the balance of our country. It's a little bit scary to think about. So I'm just constantly thinking about how can we support the communities that are getting rocked by this current issue.
You know, you, as I said, you're relatively new to South Florida, and wondering what are your impressions of the region education wise from what you've seen so far?
Yeah, I love it here. It was always on my list of places I'd want to go, even though I spent a decade in New York, which might be surprising to some people. But my wife grew up here. You know, the weather is unbeatable, which is probably why so many people are trying to come here and I can't afford a house right now. But what is interesting is that it's so diverse. There's so many rich cultures. There's so much, you know, racial history and racial pride, and fostering those things really helps students. And so there's also like a resource here that we have to tap into and not make it an us versus them kind of thing where people are fighting for resources. Rather, if we can create solidarity amongst groups that are feeling left behind or underfunded, there is so much more potential in our education. And I think Carvalho did a great job of prioritizing student learning up until now. Surprisingly, so many different stakeholders liked him, which is so hard to find. So I really hope the next person understands the essentials of student learning and understands that there are so many non-academic needs that affect academic outcomes. Because, you know, Florida and all of South Florida and Miami can really play a pinnacle role in making sure that the future of this entire country looks better than it does.
And so much change here in South Florida. You're talking about from Palm Beach County down to Miami-Dade. New superintendents, all the positions are changing. Let me finish with this. How does the work you're doing right now at FIU contribute to your ideas about public education and that opportunity gap you're talking about?
So, you know, currently, I also just became a new dad. So I've only been in Florida about 6 months, at which time I've also had twins. And so my main portal to Miami has been my students at FIU, and I teach educational leadership. So I'm teaching these students who are aspiring to become principals or administrators. And it's been really amazing to see that despite them coming from different communities where they represent so many different stakeholders and parents and cultures, everyone essentially cares fundamentally to make sure that their students thrive. You know, my students call their students their kids. And that's something you'll find it for educators across the country. And it's that kind of like solidarity that I think we really have to capitalize on. And so what I'm trying to do now is find those bright spots around Miami and the greater area that are helping, you know, those students thrive who we would typically, if we were to look at the metrics, like, you know, Black and brown kids coming from below poverty all qualify for free and reduced lunch, but those schools are thriving. That's what I think we need to look into and research so that we can share those best practices with other schools everywhere. And I have, you know, some idea on how to do that, but every context is different.
You know what? I got to bring you back. There's a lot to talk about and there's plenty to discuss with education here in South Florida. Again, sociologist Anindya Kundu, he's an assistant professor of educational leadership at FIU. And again, check out his TED Talk. We're going to post it up on our website, WLRN.org. Anindya, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. We'll talk again
soon. Thank you, Lewis. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Well, still to come, let's take a moment to just share some moments of joy. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. 2021 was a year of a lot of change. New president, vaccines, going back to the office, at least for some of us. You know, but it was still a whiplash of a year, and it had its difficult moments, but you already know about that. Well, the WLRN newsroom had an end-of-the-year tradition a few years back to compile the weird Florida stories of the year. We decided there's too much weird, so we switched it to a new tradition to search for more joy. WLRN Keys reporter Nancy Klingener took it upon herself to help our reporters gather their personal moments of joy that they found out about in South Florida. And I just wanted to bring that energy as we kick off 2022. Nan joins us now. Nan, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Lewis, thank you for asking.
I'm doing okay. It's all right. It's all right. So tell me, Nan, how did this tradition from finding the weird stories to the joy, where did that start? You started it.
Yeah, I mean, it was the end of the year. And, you know, I mean, I don't think it's a secret that news organizations do these year in review stories to sort of fill space and provide content at a time when, you know, we're pretty short staffed because people are out on holiday. And also because a lot of our sort of, you know, meat and potatoes coverage is of government and politics and none of that stuff's going on. So, you know, the year in review is a great tradition in the news business. And we had always done that weird Florida review because, of course, Florida is really great at providing that kind of content. But at the end of 2020, it was just like, you know, we really need to think about things that brought us joy this last year. And some things did. And it's important to remember that, I think.
All right. So I want to ask you, what was your favorite moment of joy of 2021?
Well, my contribution, which didn't end up in the feature length segment, but ended up running separately, is about an art exhibit in New York City that I saw when I went north this summer to see my family for the first time in 2 years. And there was a show at the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York City, which is the Smithsonian's Design Museum. And it focused on the work of an artist from Key West named Susie Zuzek. And it turns out she was actually the designer behind all those Lilly Pulitzer prints that were such a sensation in the 60s and 70s and into the 80s. And, you know, Jackie Kennedy wore them and they were huge. And Lilly Pulitzer was this really well-known socialite. But the person who was actually behind those prints was an artist from Key West.
Still popular today, like in Palm Beach County.
Right.
And by the way, one of the things I love too about the story is that you remind us that very famous people have spent time in Key West, but so often we focus on them and they're men, that there are women, many incredible women who've done such awesome stuff too that live in Key West.
That's right. Susie Zuzek was one. The poet Elizabeth Bishop was another. There are a lot of great women who have spent time here and are still spending time here.
I think you already know that a lot of us already look at you with this jealousy, like, she lives in Key West. Life's got to be awesome all the time down there, right? It's a joyful place always, right?
No, it's still a real place on planet Earth, unfortunately, in a way. And, you know, it's certainly a joyful place for a lot of people who like to visit. But living here can be pretty tough. It's very expensive. You know, you have the concerns about sea level rise and stuff like that. Mm. So I wouldn't say that, but I would say that a lot of locals are pretty good at finding joy just in things like going to look at the sunrise or the sunset every day having a dance party on the beach, which people I know did during the pandemic as a way to be together and celebrate life safely outside.
I've asked this of all of our reporters. What are you looking forward to this year? Is there some big story or big event that you're looking forward to?
You know, I don't think there is a single big event I'm looking forward to this year. I am really, really hoping that we can get back to gathering, you know, as we used to in large numbers and you know, doing things as we used to do them
and
traveling and all that stuff.
Have you heard anything about Fantasy Fest? Is it going to come back fully?
As far as I know, but you know, you never know. But yeah, as far as I know, yes. I believe the organizers are actually in talks with the city now about, you know, maybe some changes to the nature of the event, but you know, that is yet to be seen.
Well, Nan, I want to thank you so much for coming up with this idea of, you know, the joyful moments, and it's definitely helped. And I got a little piece of it that I want to play here, but thank you again for putting it together, because it really does help.
Oh, thank you, Lewis.
All right. And have a joyful 2022, for heaven's sakes.
And you as well.
All right. Let's listen to some joy from this past year.
I'm Danny Rivero in Miami. The Cuban national hero and poet Jose Martí once said, "There's three things that every person needs to do to live their most fulfilling life. Have a child, write a book, and plant a tree." And so it made me so happy to see Edward Prado scratching off that last one at the tender age of 4. And not planting just one tree.
20.
He's got big dreams of planting even more.
20. Tantas. Es un bosque.
No, 10,000. Tengo 10,000.
I met Edward at a tree planting event at Larry and Penny Thompson Park in South Dade. It was part of an ongoing effort to plant 1 million new trees in Miami-Dade County. That's to help offset rising temperatures by providing shade to residents. I actually talked with Edward the morning after the Surfside condo collapse, when I was deeply in need of something to smile about. And then he kept going. Little Edward started schooling me about why you need to take the rocks out of the dirt before planting a tree.
Porque después las raíces van a estar con las piedras.
Exactamente.
Y la piedra no la queremos en la raíz.
It's because the rocks will get in the way of the roots. Edward named the slash pine he planted after himself, and his mom promised to bring him back to visit and watch it grow.
I'm Jenny Stiletovich, WLRN's environmental reporter. Coral reefs are in trouble, especially in Florida and the Caribbean, where they're fighting both climate change and stony coral disease.
It is a lot of doom and gloom. I mean, it's hard.
When I talked with University of Miami researcher Nikki Traylor-Knowles in July, she was blunt about her frustration.
I gave a public talk recently and I started crying because it was just like, as I was talking about it, I was like, oh my gosh, this is just so hard.
But her research on genetics this year gave us all reason to hope. She found that some corals infected with stony coral disease had an immune response. That means they have the ability to fight back.
I don't want to oversell and say that we're anywhere near like human medicine, but we are really trying to create, you know, a toolkit so that we can better diagnose corals and as a way in which to better inform policies and other things to help save them.
The breakthrough may seem like a small thing, but in a world besieged by disease, it definitely counts as glad tidings.
I'm Wilkin Brutus in Palm Beach County. In some ways, 2021 felt like season 2 of 2020, and I'm not quite sure what episode we're in right now, but during what seems like a never-ending pandemic series, the return of live, in-person music and art events was a much-needed silver lining that brightened my mood. The Boca Raton Museum of Art highlighted ancient artifacts from Machu Picchu. An eclectic community activation in West Palm Beach brought entrepreneurs, musicians, and artists together. A local country music star serenaded locals into the holiday season. And a traditional African drum circle at a farm in Loxahatchee promoted community healing and healthy eating. There was an underlying sense of comfort and optimism in these shared spaces. And when I reported these stories, I found a kind of solidarity that I had been yearning for more than a year.
Love the beat. You just heard from WLRN reporters Danny Rivero, Jenny Stiletovich, and Wilkin Brutus. Loads more moments of joy at WLRN.org. See, not all the news is bad. And that's Sundial for this Wednesday, January 5th, 2022. By the way, just wanted to mention, we had a Democratic lawmaker on earlier today. I just want to mention that I have reached out to half a dozen different Republican state lawmakers to join the show. Just trying to get anybody on the program. I'm making the effort. We always make the effort to make sure that we hear from all sides on this program. Didn't get anybody, but hopefully during the session, we can get some of them on the program. Katie Munoz is our lead producer. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. Jessica Bakeman is our senior news editor. WLRN's interim program director and technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And the theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo at gopalo.com. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Florida Power and Light is lobbying to change solar panel policy. We're going to dig into a story with a South Florida environmental reporter who wrote about it for The Guardian recently. Plus, we're excited to catch up with Carlos Frias, who writes all about food for the Miami Herald. We're going to ask him about where to eat in South Florida for 2022. And also, we're going to ask, what the heck about the sale of Shorty's Barbecue? What does it mean for that iconic spot? All of that coming up tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Take care of each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media. You're tuned to 91.3 WLRN and HD1, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, 91.5 WKWM and HD1, Marathon, Key West, 105.5 WOLL HD2, Hope Sound, and 101.9 NPR for the Palm Beaches.